Senate would come to order.
Diane, I didn't. I like my sheet. She gave me down
there. Okay. Messages from the House.
January the 29th, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 35, Election Judges. Ayes 59, noes 1. House Bill 60, Sex Offenses by Corrections Personnel. Ayes 60. House Bill 111, Clean Coal Task Force, ayes 60. House Bill 207, Internet Hunting, ayes 56, noes 0. Huh? Oh, correction on the vote on the last one. It's ayes 56, noes 4. January the 29th, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 49, Game Bird Farms Raising Sage Grouse. Ayes 60. House Bill 26, Circuit Court Magistrate Jurisdiction. Ayes 60. House Bill 47, Commercial Signage on Highways. Ayes 59, noes 1. House Bill number 59, Liquor Licenses Golf Clubs. Ayes 59, noes 1. House Bill number 76, Election Code Revisions, ayes 60. House Bill number 83, Governmental Immunity, Public Transportation, ayes 59, noes 1. House Bill number 113, Careless Driving, ayes 53, noes 7. House Bill 84, Economic Development, Property Tax Exemption, ayes 50, noes 10. House Bill number 112, Workforce Housing Program, ayes 37, noes 23. House Bill 186, Gasoline Tax, Agricultural Exemption 2. Ayes 54, noes 6. And House Bill 190, Driver's License Suspension, Child Support. Ayes 37, noes 23. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills in first reading. House Bill 60, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 60, sponsored by Representative Buchanan, Sex Offenses by Corrections Personnel and Act Relating to Crimes and Offenses. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 60.
House Bill 60 has been referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 207, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 207, sponsored by Representative Carson, Internet Hunting, an Act Relating to Game and Fish. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 56, noes 4.
House Bill 207 have been referred to Committee number 6, Travel. House Bill 35, first reading of the bill.
House House Bill Number 35, sponsored by Representative Millen, Election Judges, and Act Relating to Elections, passed the House on third reading. Ayes 59, noes 1.
House Bill 35 had been referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. House Bill 111.
House Bill Number 111, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, Clean Coal Task Force, and Act Relating to the Clean Coal Tax Force. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 111 have been referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at our order of business, consideration of bills in general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Senator Hastert.
Committee of the Whole is back in order. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 21. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 21, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee. Subdivisions located within irrigation districts. An act relating to subdivisions. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Geis, Jennings, Johnson, and Vases. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Geis.
I move that Senate File 20 do pass. And I'd like to have a standing committee amendment read in.
Senate File 21, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 22.
And I move the standing committee amendment to Senate File 21, and I'll give Senator Bebout to explain the bill.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, Senate File 21 was brought to the Ag Committee by the irrigation districts, and the whole purpose of this bill is to have them more involved in the subdivision process. And if you look at the statutes 185306 on page 1, that's the statutes in our law that gets the county commissioners involved in the subdivision process. And if you look at that language, the board requires certain information before those subdivisions will proceed, and part of it has to do with water and water rights. And if you look in the statutes under Subtitle 9, you can see there are several things that these water rights have to do with a state engineer, if, in fact, there are water rights involved with the subdivision. And the choices they have, they either can relinquish their rights, or they can change the use point of diversion, or they can spread those water rights out to the owners of the subdivision. And what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is it gets into the language as to how the irrigation districts are treated before. All they had to do was be notified of the fact that this is going on, a subdivision is being created, and it's within their irrigation district. Now what we do, if you look on page 2, starting with line 19 and going through line 23, as we talk about, and then on to the next page, for two more pages, it says that if, in fact, a subdivision is located within the irrigation district that is subject to the provisions of Title 41, Title 41 being Water Law of Wyoming, the application shall include a recommendation from the irrigation district on a form approved by the district, and it talks about their water rights and their easements. So that would be something that the county commissioners would have to have from the irrigation district. And, Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, I'd like to discuss a standing committee amendment. If you'll look on page 2, line 22, during the committee, it thought that we should give them some time to respond. Rather than shall include, they said, or be supplemented with a 60-day period. So the irrigation district, if they couldn't include their recommendation when the plat was filed, they had 60 days to supplement it and send that in. And with that, I would ask for the question on the standing committee amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 21, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second part of the bill is on page 3, begins with line 4, subsection G. And this is an important part. It deals with the indemnification of the irrigation districts. There are certain circumstances that could exist out there where the subdivision is platted. It could be a canal, and the subdivision is around the canal, and they may have lots to back up to the canal. And it was felt that if the subdivider or the developer wants to, in fact, have a subdivision in that kind of a situation, that the irrigation district should not be responsible for the way they subdivide the land. And, Mr. Chairman, that's the purpose of this, is to provide them with that liability protection.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, series of questions. First, with regard to the indemnification, the circumstance we were just talking about, where you have a series of lots that back up to the canal. With this section, if the canal needs to be, say, fenced to keep kids from getting over there, playing in a situation where it's dangerous, where they'd be, say, at some risk of drowning because the water was too deep, or get swept into a siphon or something like that, with this section, with the subdivider then be responsible for putting that kind of fencing in? Is this section adequate for that? And in part, I'm hoping that some of the attorneys in the body will take a look and see if the language would accomplish that purpose. Second, suppose you had a situation where there was a rural or an urban-type subdivision, and a bunch of land was taken out of agricultural production, would no longer be there and meeting obligations that the irrigation district might have, say, if it had a loan for construction of facilities or something like that. And then so each of the other irrigators that remained in the district would then have to pay more. Would this subsection deal with that? Mr. Chairman, that's my two questions on this subsection, and then I've got another question.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, to answer the second question first, there's three things that can happen if, in fact, a subdivision occurs and it's an area where the lands are irrigated. They will no longer be irrigated after that. The developer has a choice, and it all deals with the water rights on that particular piece of ground. They can vacate them, and then in that case, they can go back to the people that own lands within that irrigation district and say, I want to be able to take this extra land on. Therefore, they will continue to pay the amount of money that they have to pay per acre. The other thing is they can change the point of diversion, the use of the water. They still have to pay. The third thing is they can allocate to all the people in that particular subdivision. If it's 10 one-acre lots, then they will say, okay, you 10 one-acre lots, you each have one-tenth of that total package of land within that subdivision. You're responsible for one-tenth of the charge. So that's the long answer. The short answer is the obligations will stay there. As to the first one, I think that we're not the concern about the indemnification, whether it's on the developer or it's on the person that owns the lot. That's something that we never got into. We are more concerned about indemnifying the district from the exposure when they have no control over it. And that's the purpose of this language, because once that piece of ground is subdivided, then in fact the developer has a responsibility, and then when he sells the lot, then I would assume would transfer to the owner of the lot. If he chose not to put a fence up, I guess he could sue the irrigation district. However, if that happens, then they are indemnified.
Any further discussion? Senator Scott.
Senator Scott. Is that subdivision, the district will bring that water to a certain point, and then it'll be up to the developer to distribute the water. They're out of it from there on.
Senator Scott.
And that's important, because those things can be a real headache to the management of a district. Mr. Chairman, I think we need to look at this and see if we need a second reading amendment. So if there are safety features that need to be put in, and fencing to keep kids from playing in dangerous places, is one of them. I think that responsibility ought to be on the subdivider so that it gets done, and 20 years down the road, the irrigation district doesn't get sued because they didn't protect their facilities from kids getting in trouble. I think that's a very real concern, and so that the kids are protected and they don't get in trouble in the first place. Mr. Chairman, as I read this bill, it goes to all subdivisions, and that would include the new large acre ones, where you've got lot sizes between 35 and 140 acres. Was there discussion in the committee? Is that really needed on those, or are they just going to continue to be regular, ordinary customers of the irrigation district? And was that particular issue discussed, and if so, what was it?
Senator Bebout.
Chairman, I don't recall talking about the larger subdivisions, but of course understand that law. That gives the county commissioners the right to do that if they want. And of course, as I understand that, they could require plats. And if they require plats, then they would have to go through the same procedure for the 35 to 140 acre parcels as they would for 2 acre parcels. So I guess it's the answer is, if in fact they do subdivide it and it goes through the platting process, all of these same procedures would happen. Now the one exemption is for the simple subdivisions. If it's one time divided in 5 or fewer tracts, these provisions don't apply, and there are a lot of other provisions that do not apply either, unless the county commissioners want them to apply.
Any further discussion? Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I guess when the committee looked at this, if they consider it in terms of what you're really doing is taking the rights of the property owner away and giving it the rights to another property owner. I can envision, I mean, right now, if you own property, you have generally a right to subdivide it. You own the property. If you have a ditch going through your property, whoever has the ditch rights has rights there. They've got property rights. And now what the legislature is going to come in and say the ditch right, whoever has the ditch rights, the conveyance rights, their rights are more valuable than your land. And we're going to take your rights to develop, and we're going to give it to them. And I think it's kind of an interesting analysis where you have one property owner that actually has water rights from the ditch. The next owner down has a ditch going through his property. He owns no water rights. So all he's got a conveyance. And what happens is that you own water rights, you own land, and you decide you want to move those water rights, do a petition for change of use, put it on a different piece of land. So you go to develop your land, and the neighbors that have the ditch say, well, you know what? We're not going to consent to that unless you give us those water rights, and we're going to redistribute them among ourselves. If you don't like that, then we're going to go to the commissioners and say you shouldn't develop your land. You essentially take the rights, the property rights, that the guy that has the land, and you just gave some of the rights to the guy that's got the water because now he can hold it over to you. Why not do it for oil and gas developer? Go to the commission and said you can't develop your oil and gas unless you've got the surface owner's consent, and until you've reached the right amount of payment, you just can't ever mine. And what I wonder is, why is it, what is so wrong about our property statute right now that just regular old property rights, what you were granted when you bought your land, what's so insufficient about them to resolve the dispute that may exist?
Further discussion, Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, if you're talking about subsection F, and I think that's what you're talking about, let's get back to what we're trying to do here. If you own a piece of land and you own the water rights, they're your right. That's your property. And then I choose to sell that or develop it myself. Those water rights go with that property. When I go through the subdivision process, there are certain things I can do with those water rights. They're still my water rights, and those are the three options I told you about. You can vacate them. You can give them back to the district, and then they have a chance, they have an opportunity to do with them as they wish. Or you can change the point of diversion or the use, or you can split them among the subdivision and the land you already own. That property right does not go away. It stays with the person that owned it in the first place. And that's the person that owned the land that had the original water rights. If you're talking about the indemnification, that's a different issue. So I, and all we're talking about in this bill is saying when we go through that process, we're just changing instead of when you have a subdivision that you ask and you notify the irrigation district that something's going on with a subdivision, you're asking them to recommend to the commissioners that we have in writing what their concerns are relative to their water rights and their easements. And that's all we're doing.
Senator Nicholas.
I don't think that's all you're doing. What you're doing is you're saying the existing water rights are, and the property rights that exist with the land and with the water are insufficient to have the parties resolve their respective rights. And you're saying to one group of owners of property rights, we're going to give you an extra stick, a club. And if you want to use that stick or club to try to force a vacation of the rights so he can't sell them or transfer them, then you can use it any way you want. With respect to the indemnification, same thing. You're saying now you get to insist that you can't make a change unless you sign a document indemnifying me for anything that might happen. So go to oil and gas. Good example. If you want to put oil and gas well on my property and you want to use my roads, then you have to go out and give me an indemnification that says anything that might happen with anybody that's traveling out to that rig because of our well site has to indemnify me from anything that might happen. Why? Because when the oil and gas person who has a dominant estate, he's putting more use on that property, and that might expose me to more. And how does that right get utilized? It gets utilized to insist and to demand on compensation. It's a club. And, you know, we've been through these disputes where guy develops it and the neighbor's saying, well, if you're going to develop it, I want those water rights. I'll do the change of use, or I want the conveyance rights. In fact, I'd like a club to figure out how to force you to do something you don't want to do. Now, the way water rights exist right today, if you own the property in or around, whether you own water rights or not, you cannot do anything to impair the rights of the other owners. So if you want to take your water rights out, you have to give up some conveyance rights. You can't change the ditch without their approval because they've got an easement. I submit to you the existing water rights, water law, protects all the respective owners. And your property rights are correlative. And they may, who has a dominant estate, who has the subservient estate, is dependent upon when they acquired it, what the agreements were. And all this is an effort to go in and say, look, we want to give one property right owner more value to what he has than he already had the day before. He said, we're going to write you a check. And we're going to write the check out of his pocket and his pocket so you can have more rights. Because in the end, if you have a ditch, and it goes through your property, the other people have a right to have their water conveyed. There's no, you know, we've all grown up in communities where their ditch is going right down through the neighborhoods. Been happened since towns were built. It's never been that big of a problem. What's happening now is guys are saying, you know, if you're going to develop your property, I want your water rights. You got to come talk to me because I think my rights are more important to yours. And I submit to you, that's what we have. Property right law, water right law that's well developed in that regard.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, before we start seeing things that go bump in the night, let's look at what the bill actually does. You're talking about, you look page 2, line 22, you're talking about a recommendation. You're not talking about any absolute right to say no. You're talking about the right to make a recommendation. And you have, frankly, it's a mess in a number of these areas where you've got subdivisions that are coming into irrigation districts. You get either they just take the land out of production, in which case You've got a water right. You've got some obligations to meet, some financial obligations. They aren't being met. They say, well, we aren't going to deliver your water. It doesn't make any difference. Or they keep the water rights active, and where you had one headgate to regulate out of the canal, you got 50. And they all want it on the weekend, and they don't want any of it during the week. And it's a difficult proposition. So we aren't successfully dealing with that set of issues right now. And we need legislation like this to do that. Look at the indemnification. That's an effort to say, okay, you're changing around the circumstance that we've had for years with this irrigation district, and fine, you have the right to do what you will with your own property, but where you're harming your neighbors that have been participants with you, where you've shared this obligation, they need some protection, because what you're doing is potentially hurting them, and that's only fair. And that's been the really, in many ways, the basic principle in our water rights for years, Mr. Chairman, that if you change your water rights and you harm some other appropriator, you have to take responsibility for that. It has to be mitigated one way or another. This isn't exactly water rights, but it's the same kind of principle. You're doing something new, you're subdividing property, you may hurt the other people who historically you have shared expenses with. Maybe we need to clean the language up a bit or something, but I think it's very important that we pass this bill or something like it, because we got a real problem out there.
Senator Burns.
Just for my education here, I understand what the bill's aimed at, and it's aimed at somebody who's subdividing land that has some of those water rights in it. Does it affect land that where the only has the water right going through it? They don't own any of the water rights. It's only a right of conveyance through that property, if that is the case. The other question I have is, I'm wondering on the line 22, where the application shall include a recommendation from the irrigation district. Does that mean that if that recommendation is not included, does that mean that the county commissioners cannot, or the county planning commission, whichever, cannot accept that application? Is that a way of actually canceling out a subdivision? And the third question I have, I'm just wondering on line 23, why it has to be on a form approved by the irrigation district. That I'm trying to figure out why that language is in there.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the first issue, if a ditch goes through it, it's one of the reasons why I think this bill is important, because when they send their recommendation to the county commissioners, they will show their easements. And if it's within the irrigation district, that doesn't necessarily mean that the land that's being subdivided will have water rights. It could be within the irrigation district but not have water rights. So they will show where the easement to the ditch is. And in Fremont County, sometimes where the easement is and where it really is on the land have been different, and that's another issue, but it's important to know where that is. The second thing is about the regulation in terms of the recommendation, the word shall. As I interpret this language, they shall get the recommendation to the county commissioners. They do what they want to with it, because ultimately that has to be approved by the county commissioners anyway after it goes to the county zoning and planning commission. And the third question is the form. You know, the district brought us this language. They wanted a form that would be easy for them to put together that would work on the plat. You know, if you got better language, we're open to that. I would hope the body would vote for this bill. It's really important, and I really don't see the connection that my colleague from Albany County is talking about with property rights, and because all we're talking about is recommending a way to do this so the irrigation district is involved in the process. And I'm talking about F. Now, the indemnification, I can see there might be some issues there. But we're just saying recommend. If you go back and look at existing law on pages 2, lines 11 through 17, you can see that we used to have irrigation district in there, and we moved it down here. So instead of just letting them know by a letter that we were doing it, we're asking them to recommend to us what their water rights are and what their easements are. I don't see the connection on how it affects their property rights, but if I'm wrong, we'll sure take a look at it because nobody supports private property rights more than I do.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the question was raised, can the irrigation district stall the project by not putting in the required recommendation? I think the Standing Committee Amendment was trying to get at that because with the Standing Committee Amendment, you see that the application has to include or be supplemented within 60 days by. I think that maybe that doesn't quite get the job done, and maybe the application needs to include evidence that the district was given notice and has 60 days to provide a recommendation, or it's too late. So you have a duty then of the irrigation district to actually provide the recommendation, so they can't, by inaction, hold the thing up. That's, I think, a much doable second reading amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, then I have another question. This is largely but not entirely written for irrigation district circumstances, but there is some language on page 3, line 5, that would suggest to me it might apply to a little broader than that. And my question is, does it apply to the circumstance where you don't have an irrigation district? You've got private ditches. And I'll tell you, I raise that question because in my valley, virtually every irrigator there has a head gate and a ditch on the property of the next neighbor upstream. Because you got to get some fall to get it up high enough to get it on the ground. So when they homesteaded it, they had to go upstream from their homestead and put their irrigation ditch in, often done cooperatively. But you frequently have that circumstance, and you really would need the same set of protections under those circumstances. So I want to make sure, I'm not 100% sure from reading it, that it does apply to that.
Senator Geis.
Well, you might have to put an amendment in there but if you have a ditch that's not on your property, you better have an easement. If you don't, then you're in big trouble already under Wyoming law.
Senator Nicholas.
You know, folks, for folks that have these ditch companies, irrigation districts, they have bylaws typically, and they have, some of them don't actually. There are a lot of ditches out there that they forgot to record easements. You want to go look at Wheatland Irrigation Canal number 1, there's not a single easement for any of that. It goes through property, it's a historic ride. But those rights then are, they're vested in you, and you've got them. And in fact, I've got issues right now on that would involve these. But right now, if you own the water rights and you want to go make adjustments to them, either point of diversion or if you want to apply the water someplace else, the arbitrator of that dispute is the state engineer. You've got to do your application. The state engineer undertakes to analyze it, and your rights with respect to your water rights are going to be arbitrated by the state engineer. If you don't own water rights and you want to go develop your property and you want to change the course of the ditch, once again, you've got to go to the people that own the ditch to talk about whether you can convey it or change the conveyance. And if parties have a dispute for things that don't fall within the realm of the jurisdiction of the state engineer, you go to the courts. The concern I have now is that we have the courts resolving issues of property rights between the folks, and you have the state engineer doing the water rights. Now what you're doing is saying that if you got a beef and you have a recommendation and you have an idea that you think would be great, you can take your recommendations to the county commissioners, and the county commissioners are going to now be involved in trying to sort out what your rights are and make recommendations. And you may or may not like that. You may find that you've got county commissioners that are love the idea of developments and frankly think that those ranchers are standing in the way of development. And then now you're saying, well, if you give them a recommendation, it assumes the fact the county commissioners have some capacity to act on those recommendations as a condition to granting you a right to subdivide. Commissioners say, well, we think this is what ought to happen. And if you, the flip side of it is, you might have county commissioners that think there ought to be no development. And they said, you know, we just, you got all that water out there, and frankly, we kind of like having the water where it is, so we just don't think that you can ever meet any recommendations. And historically, we've not had the county commissioners in the business of accepting or taking recommendations to decide what to do with respect to the property owner rights as between somebody that's got water rights and somebody that doesn't. We leave those to someone else. County commissioners are in the business of doing land use planning, trying to make sure that your communities develop well and how they're going to do it. They're not in the business, and they don't have the expertise, and simply put, if you're a rancher or you're a developer, you really don't want the county commissioners in telling you how to sell your land, whether you can sell it, or whether or not you can use the ditch, you can move the ditch, you can use the water, or as my good colleague from Casper is, should they put a line it with concrete and put a barrier over it. Those are things that just don't belong with the county commissioners.
Any further discussion? Any further discussion? You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 21, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 21 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 34. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File Number 34, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee, beginning Agriculture Producer Finance Authority, an act relating to the administration of government. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Geis, Jennings, Johnson, and Vasey. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Geis?
Me, the whole rod and report. I move that Senate File 34 do pass, and I'll yield the floor to Senator Johnson to explain the bill.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 34 was brought to the Ag Committee by the Business Council, specifically the agribusiness part of the Business Council, as another tool that they could use for the development, future development of agriculture in Wyoming. Federal legislation gives authority for the Ag Producer Bond Programs. 16 states have operated an Ag Producer Bond Program. And the state establishes a beginning ag producer bonding program that can authorize issuance of tax-exempt bonds. In exchange for tax-exempt bonds, the banks provide loans to the beginning farmers and ranchers at a lower interest rate. The private lender and producer negotiate the terms of the loan, and there is no risk to the state. And the finance authority approves the bond. The eligibility for this is established by the IRS. The beginning farmer or rancher cannot have had a direct or indirect ownership in substantial farmland, which is defined as a farmland larger than 30% of the median size farm in the county. And they, at that point, are talking about the management of the farm. The eligibility
Okay, the lending restrictions are also determined in the IRS code. They may not borrow more than $469,200, and that's adjusted annually for inflation. And they can buy from a related person if they pay the fair market value or the seller has less than 10% interest in the farming operation. Now, that prevents refinancing an existing operation, lower cost. And it can pay for land, ag improvements, and depreciable property, including breeding livestock. Proceeds can't be used for working capital. The advantages to the young farmer ranchers, it allows young people and first-time operators to get a start in agriculture at a lower interest rate. It allows purchase of machinery and breeding stock, not just real estate. It can be combined with other loan options, such as Farm Service Agency down payment program. The advantage to the lenders, to the banks, the bond is a qualified small issue bond which provides tax-exempt interest to the lender, and it creates a new business opportunity for the lender. The lender can be the banker for this farmer or rancher for the next decades. Advantages to the state of Wyoming, the state is not the lending entity and does not compete with private industry. There's no financial risk to the state. And it supports family farming and ranching, and again, it provides the industry with another tool. A typical ag bond transaction. The lender agrees to make a loan to a beginning producer. They complete the application. The completed application is sent to the Ag Producer Development Bond Authority that's in this bill. The application is reviewed by the finance authority to determine eligibility and then hopefully approved. Public notice is published and issuance of the bond is approved. The bond is created and is identical to the loan terms. The lender purchases the bond from the authority and the proceeds are loaned to the beginning ag producer. The ag producer signs the note. The note is assigned by the bond issuer to the lender. And the lender has tax-exempt bond backing by the underlying loan. In Senate File 34 specifically, Mr. Chairman, the Board of Directors of the Authority will consist of five members appointed by the Chairman of the Wyoming Business Council. One of them will be a member of the Business Council who shall be the Chairman, and one member of the Wyoming Board of Agriculture, one livestock producer, one crop producer, and one at-large member. And they'll be appointed annually and shall not serve no more than three consecutive one-year terms. And at this point, Mr. Chairman, I stand ready for questions.
Any further discussion? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motions that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 34, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Nay. Senate File 34 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 38. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File Number 38, sponsored by the Transportation Committee, Real ID Compliance, an act relating to the Federal Real ID Act. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. It reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Geis, Landon, Von Flatern. No, Senator Escobel, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the Committee of the Whole rise to report, I ask that you so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 38,
Mic check.
Is it working? Well, I shall repeat myself, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask that do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 38, and I will explain the bill. Senate File 38 is the Real ID compliance. I think most of you have heard about it. If you've gone to any of the national meetings of legislators, it's been a big hot topic. When it first came out from the federal government, it had huge implications. People were screaming millions upon millions of dollars needed to be spent, an unfunded federal mandate. At that time, Wyoming was bouncing between $6, $8, $10, $11 million was the numbers we were originally given to implement this, 18 to 25 employees. Well, things toned down a little bit. The federal government has made some concessions in certain areas. And so we are starting with this bill to give the Wyoming Department of Transportation some direction and some authority to begin that process of complying with Real ID. So prior to December 31st of 2009, we needed to seek an extension for the issuing of Real ID compliant licenses. So we have asked for our extension. We've been granted the extension, and we're hoping that we can comply by January of next year and have in place all the issues involved with Real ID so we can start issuing shortly after January, or pretty much on January 1st of 2010, Real ID licenses to those that come up for renewal. The timeline for this is that by December 1st of 2014, anybody under the age of 50 at that time will have to have a Real ID compliant license. So the goal is to put everything in place and be ready by January 1 of 2010 to start issuing these licenses so we don't have this great rush on November 30th of 2014 with everybody lined up that's under 50 years old trying to get their license. As your four-year license, your license is good for 4 years. As it comes due over the next 4 years, you'll get a Real ID compliant license. Some of the major requirements that Wyoming is either already doing, and understand that we're already doing a lot of this, or that we need to do take care of, is capturing all the digital, all the photos when you apply for license in digital format, which most are right now. We need to just make sure all are. Require all applicants to present required source documents. This is probably the biggest single change. You will have to go in and prove who you are. Certify. You'll see in the bill that there's a list of documents that are acceptable, passport being one, a notarized birth certificate being another, and then there's some other listings in there which I'll show you when we get into the bill. That'll be the single biggest change, and also the state of Wyoming will have to keep a scanned image of everything you present to them in and store it somewhere. So there will be some storage costs, and we are now doing rules and regulations or developing procedures to do that. States must verify Social Security numbers of each applicant. We already do that. States must verify lawful status in the United States. Wyoming currently meets this requirement. States must verify all documents used as source documents. So not only do you walk in with your passport, then they have to verify it. Wyoming, we need to change statutes to reflect this and establish an expiration date for the ID cards, which is 8 years. A state's license must contain minimum security features of at least three levels of security. Wyoming current license meets the basic requirement. We'll need to change some of the features on the current license to include the Real ID identifier and add an additional audit feature as to how we prove that license meets the requirements. States must use full legal name. Wyoming currently requires a legal name. States must use a machine-readable technology on the driver's license consisting of certain data elements. Right now, your current license uses an approved barcode system. States may only issue temporary licenses to aliens for the duration of the stay. Wyoming is in full compliance with this rule. States must submit an approved security plan for all facilities used in the production of the license and ID cards. We're going to have to change that slightly. Right now, they're currently printed in Wyoming. To bring the cost down, we'll probably have to go to a national facility that will be distributing to many states, and that way our cost for them to be compliant with this, which is background checks for all employees and security of the plant, will be distributed, that cost will be distributed among many of their customers instead of making our one small producer here in the state, unfortunately, we'd have to pay his whole security issue, and that would make this very expensive. States must establish an effective procedure to conform identity of remote reissued licenses. So we'll need additional staff to perform our mail-in renewal program due to the increase in processing. States must re-verify the Social Security number, lawful status, and validate addresses and identity during renewal. We'll need some additional labor to do this, and I'll explain the additional employees and how they plan on using those. Perform background checks and reference checks on all employees that work for DOT and the driver's license division. So anybody that issues you a license, anybody that's doing any of the document work, will have to have a background check. We currently do not do that. So in the bill, there's approval or permission for them to do background checks and go to the national FBI data file system and find out whether or not they do pass or are not listed there. And we have to train all driver license employees in fraudulent document identification security awareness. We presently do that. And several of the items that we just need to document and send into the Department of Homeland Security, we presently do, which is technical and physical safeguards to protect the personally identifiable information maintained in Department of Motor Vehicle Records. We match all the requirements they have. We just need to document and submit it. And then we must develop an emergency incident response plan. Once again, we do that, plus the new facility would have to give us theirs. We'd have to approve it. We have to document it all, send it in Department of Homeland Security. So before December 1 of 2014, everyone under the age of 50 will need to have one of these IDs. Before December 1st of 2017, everybody else, which I can probably safely say would be the majority of this body, will have to have a real ID compliant license. So with that, I'll delve quickly into the bill, which is page 2, line 13 and 14. That permits the criminal justice personnel to release history checks, information on the driver's license personnel that we'll be using to issue these. Page 2, line 23 and 24, we'll talk about the requires driver's license personnel to submit to the background checks. Page 3, line 9, adds reference for additional paragraphs and ID card statute for tribal ID cards. So this bill covers your driver's license or just getting a Wyoming ID card, and then there's the exception in there to recognize tribal ID cards. And then there, page 4 talks again about background checks for employees. Page 4 talks about the training, document training that will have to be given to all of them. Once again, we already do the fraudulent document training. This will just have to be codified and put into the procedures that are submitted to the Department of Homeland Security. I'd like to point out, though, that on page 5, line 3, there's another word in there. Let's see. Yes, it's on page 6. I'm sorry, line 3 of page 6, where it says other documents required by the division. Those other documents are for the question always comes up. You have this person that is in their 80s, 90s even, going in to get a driver's license, can pass everything else, has not seen the birth certificate since they were born probably, and never left the country, doesn't have a passport. This other documents will allow the department to write up a procedure and say, we will accept this kind of notarized letters and some proof of where you were or where you have been for X time. Other documents for those that can't produce the list that's given in the bill on documents that can be accepted. They do change on page 8, line 6, the address requirements for mailing to the residents. Presently, you can get a P.O. box or you can get an address that is not the actual residence address that you accept your mail at. This will make it that you need to put your resident address down. And once again, other documents will allow the department to say that if you do not have utility bills, telephone bills in your name because maybe you're a roommate, you're not the actual renter or owner of the house, they can come up with a system that says you can verify your residency by some other means. All this will, of course, have to be approved by Department of Homeland Security. One question that was brought up and brought up again in appropriations would be on line 9, where we stricken the language on lines 1 through 9. Used to be able, you get a notice at 120 days, and you have that 120 days to renew your license. That language is taken out of there, which my question and the good senator from the basin here asked the same question in appropriations. Well, that's terrible. I mean, you won't get the notice. You won't have 120 days to finally make your way down there, of course, the day before it's due, and then renew it. What this says is that you can renew it at any by omitting that language, you can renew your license at any time, and the 4 years will start from that date. Before, if you had a change of address, and you walked in a week or 2 weeks before your license, or 130 days before your license was due, and changed your license to reflect your new address, your license expired 130 days later. What they've, by omitting that language, you now, when you renew it, you get 4 years from that point on. So if you go and change the address, you get 4 years. You go back a couple years later and change your, you know, the married name comes into play or something, 4 years from that point on. So we don't have this change the address and 130 days later, you've got to go in and get your license renewed. Section 31.8.101 talks about the ID cards itself. We have an amendment that will fit into there. So really the rest of the bill is just conforming. Also talks about, you know, the big issues are documents that will be needed, verification of how those documents will be and how those documents will be handled, the training they'll need for the division, for the department itself, division of the department, for their own personnel. And that is the biggest change we're making. The reality of this is that the original Real ID said, if you don't have a Real ID compliant license, and actually we passed the original date they gave the states to institute this, if you don't have it by that date, and I'm sure you've all heard this, you won't get on an airplane, you won't get into a federal building, you won't go to your own post office, they won't let you in. Or you can be in trouble for being in there should you not have a Real ID compliant license. That has been eased up too. What the federal government is saying now, should you show up in an airport and you don't have a Real ID compliant, let's say after December 1st of 2014 and you're under 50 years old, then you will go through extra security. If you come from a state like ours, at that point, should we pass this bill and get things rolling? If you come from our state, they'd wonder why you have an expired license to start with, because by then you should have had a good license. Or you would be in your four-year renewal and you would have gotten a license. So after 2017, anybody, if you come from Wyoming and have a Wyoming driver's license, it'll be compliant anyway. But if you come from a state that has not complied with this, as of that date, they are now saying you'll go through extra security. They're not saying that you won't get on the airplane. So if the question is, how restrictive are they going to get? Should we not comply? I can't answer that. They changed their mind about weekly on this particular item. But what we are doing here, for very little money, and I'll show you I'll talk about the fiscal note in a second. For very little money, we are, and $1.1 million of that is a grant from the federal government, we are tightening the security on our own licensing system, which is a good thing. We're making sure there aren't fraudulent licenses out there to the best of our ability. As we all know, once we set up one security, somebody will figure a way around it. But we're doing the best. We will have less hassle by implementing it as soon as possible. So when you renew your license, you just renewed your license. You don't have to worry about running down there the last day when everybody has to have one. So the advantage to our citizens is that we will be in compliance and they will see an easy transition. The disadvantage will be probably the source documents for some. You actually have to show up with some extra. You just can't turn your old license in and get one. That'll probably be the biggest single change. And it will cost about $500,000 a year in additional cost. The initial fiscal note, which is missing here somewhere, is about $1,072,000, a little over $1 million to implement this, and about $560,000 a year due to the $350,000 approximately that go to contractual services at about a little over a dollar additional cost per issuance of the actual license software, and about $215,000 a year that'll go towards the additional employees. So at this time, Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment number one. I'd like it read in.
Senate file number 38, standing committee amendment number one, page 5, line 2.
Senator Van Platter. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I move standing committee number one to Senate file 38 and ask that we dispense with further reading. And, Senators, this goes to page 5, line 2. There was just a typo there where they used the word not, and they meant the word now, N-O-W, instead of N-O-T. And then on page 8, the discussion in the committee was, and on page 8, line 18, subsection J, where it says any other information required by the department, we thought that was a little too broad. And we meant any other information required by the department to comply with applicable federal law. We didn't want to just say that they could make up other things that really didn't have much to do with this, and it was kind of a broad statement. We just tightened it up to say to comply with applicable federal law. And then on page 10, line 16, it goes to after page 10, line 16, delete his, insert the registrants. This will comply with the next page. We'll fit right in. We thought the gender wasn't really needed, although we do allow it in certain areas. But if you look on the next page, there is, which I don't see right now, but there is mention of a registrant. Oh, on line 11 of page 11, it says the registrant's full facial digital color photograph. So the change there is just to take out the word his and put in registrants. So at this time, Mr. Chairman, I ask for a vote on standing committee number one.
Any discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flattern's motion to adopt standing committee amendment number one to Senate file 38, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The amendment has been adopted. Senator Von Flattern.
And Mr. Chairman, there's a committee of the whole amendment number one. I'd like it read in at this time.
Senate file 38, amendment committee of the whole amendment number one, page one, line five.
Senator Von Flattern.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee of the whole amendment number one to Senate file 38 and ask that we dispense with further reading. Page one, line five, after statutes insert authorizing positions. Our committee and myself in particular did not catch the fact that there wasn't an authorization in this for employees. Now, the money is coming out of a federal grant of $1.1 million eventually, or $500,000 we've already seen, $600,000 on its way. And I know the money's in the mail, yes, I got that. But they guarantee us $600,000 on its way. So it comes out of that, and it comes out of approximately $500,000 in highway funds. But there was so there's no general fund money in this, but there was no authorization for new employees. They have in their fiscal note that they would like five employees. And I know that there was some discussion in appropriations about it. And I think to get this, I believe, and I know to get this started, we can go ahead and say this is good. There's an enactment date change, too, which was on the last amendment. And I apologize to the body that I didn't point that out, that the enactment date does change to January 1st, 2010. To get that started, to be ready to start giving out licenses so we don't have this rush in 2014 for everybody under 50 years old, to start in 2010, issuing licenses, make it fit very nicely, quick, easy transition. We need to give them some employees, and they're going to do it on three FTEs in reality, not three full-time equivalents. So they are planning on job sharing at local issuing stations, especially the big ones, which is going to be busy anyway, to start implementing this, to help with the document verification, and to help with the whole new procedure and get the training going. So this amendment says, page 1, line 5, after statutes, insert authorizing positions, and page 13, after line 10, insert and renumber section 3, the Department of Transportation is authorized three additional full-time equivalent positions to implement the purpose of this act, and page 13, line 12, delete 3, insert 4. I can tell you in support of this amendment that they right now have a 94% job approval rating by a survey taken by the University of Wyoming at our driver license issuing stations. We'd like to keep that going. That's a very good job approval. This is three full-time equivalents, so they'll spread them out. They'll do it at job sharing, a half a person at this place, a half a person here. They may end up even extending hours as we get closer to the deadline. And then they will, as of next budget, when they do the budget, they will actually put in through the regular budget process for the five full-time equivalents. So I ask for your support of Committee of the Whole number 1 to Senate File 38.
Any further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 38? Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd urge you to resist this effort and maybe on second or third reading take another look at it. But I have my recollection is that the testimony, and I'm looking at the fiscal note, there was discussion about whether it be a difference in additional positions and whether they'd be funded by a federal grant or whether they would be paid for by other funds. In this case, the other funds would be highway dollars, so they're fuel taxes that are being collected and used for highway construction. And when I see this, I don't see that the positions are time-limited for the availability of any federal funds or whether or not they're just going to grow their staff and take the dollars that they're presently using to build highways and put them into staff. And I think you ought to insist and demand as a body before you start adding positions to the highway department, you find out where they're going to be paid from. And I look at the fiscal note, I see $560,000 proposed from other funds. Those are high rate dollars. Not my understanding that you'd want to essentially direct them and authorize them to use highway dollars for that purpose. So we need to find out the answer to that first, and then if they're going to have positions that are based upon new federal grant dollars that are available, that those positions be limited to the federal dollars that are available and that they be time limited to those federal dollars.
Any further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1? Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the good chair of appropriations brings up a good point as to taking highway dollars, but you got to remember that you do pay money to get your driver's license. Now, I don't have the exact breakdown, and I'd be glad to bring this to the body tomorrow on what that division exactly makes break even or not. And so I do believe if we're going to pass this and set them up to get to be prepared by January 1 and to make this an easy transition for issuing these licenses, that we shouldn't hamstring them by not allowing any more positions and just expecting them to take care of this. It is highway funds. It's not general funds, and I, for one, want every penny possibly spent, and then much more, as I will ask later, for our roads. But this is necessary for you to be on the road and for everybody else to be on the road at some point. I ask for you to pass this amendment and allow them the three full-time equivalents and let them decide how they dole out those personnel, and hopefully we'll get some of the smaller places to get at least a half-time person there. And I know there's a shortage as it stands right now in some of those smaller driver's license issuing stations.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. And, folks, I'd urge you to resist it. We're the ones that decide how many employees they have and where they take the monies from. We don't tell agencies to go out and you can have 1,000 employees and anywhere you can get the money, that's okay. Just come on in and have whatever you want. That's not the way we budget. The legislature controls the purse strings. We control the FDAs. And whenever we create positions, we need to know where is the money going to come to pay for them and what money is going to be used so you can tell your constituents this is where your money's going.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flattern's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 38, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 38 has failed. We're back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, several questions. First, on page 10, line 16, applicant shall state full legal name. And the question I have is that I've observed a number of people over time. Their name tends to change a bit. First names get dropped. That sort of thing happens. And particular particularly a lot of women, when they get married. They will sometimes then be known by their original first name and their original middle name, and then their new, take their husband's name as the last name, or they, and that's what my mother did. Or they will take their old last name as their new middle name and be known that way. That's what my wife did. And she, in this case, she dropped her first name because it wasn't what was used. Are we going to make, is this going to be a big hassle with this new, more strict definition for particularly the female half of our population? Are we going, is this making a lot of trouble for them?
Senator Geis.
Probably no different than when you go into the military, you put your real name down. Nickname don't count.
Senator Von Schleifern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a good question, but I realize not everybody in our population uses an airline. But whatever you're doing to match your ID now to get an airline ticket, because if you, and I'll use my wife's example who's in the gallery, and she's going to kill me for this, but yeah, it's going to be a tough evening, folks. Okay. Okay, I've changed my mind on this. Okay, her official name is Margaret, and she uses Margie, and everybody has known her as Margie. I mean, I didn't really know her official name until after the, you know, several dates, but we won't go there. But anyway, and it's her middle initial is A for Ann. So I accidentally once bought her an airline ticket that said Margie von Platern, and then we didn't use it. Something came up, couldn't use it. So then we took a voucher. Of course, you get nicked for the $100 or whatever. Took a voucher for it. Never could use a voucher again because it never matched her ID, and she needed to get a ticket in the name of Margaret. So we just kind of kissed that money goodbye. But that, if so, it would be the same scenario if they're flying at all. They've already realized what their legal name is to match their ID, and if they haven't gone down and officially changed it, they would have to.
Any further discussion? Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the what you have to present as proof of who you are, you know, there's some pretty heavy-duty records in there. What kind of security do we have to put in place so that we don't ever lose those records out into the open internet and all that kind of stuff? Because that is everything you need in one place to steal somebody's identity.
Any further discussion? Senator Vasey.
Chairman, I guess I need to know what the punishment is going to be, because I can see myself getting in a lot of trouble. Because I think the first time that somebody asks me who I am or where I am, I'm going to ask them to take the documentation and roll it in a little cylinder and put it where it'll do the most good, and then I need to know whether it's going to be a felony or high misdemeanor or how much time I have to serve in Torrington or do I can stay in Rollins. You know, I know the train is on the track and I'm standing out in front of it, but I got to tell you, I cannot vote for this in good conscience because all my ragtag ancestors got on the boat to get the government out of their hair. They all left because they thought it was better to have the proof, make the government prove their case rather than them have to. And I understand all the reasons why we have to do this, but I think I'm just going to say to heck with them and see what happens.
Senator Scott.
At this point, I don't have a comment as perhaps as momentous as that. On the issue, I didn't understand the discussion on the issue of the renewal date and the anniversary date on the license. And let me see if I can explain my concern. Right now, my license, and I expect everybody else's, expires on my birthday. And that's a convenience. It helps old guys like us remember that when we got to do something. And right now, for instance, my license says issued 06-30-2005, expires 08-19-2009. Will that, with this new system and your new renewal date system, will we be able to maintain that system? So when somebody goes in a little early, they'll still get a license that expires on their birthday and does so 4 years later. Because if it doesn't, then I think we need to amend the bill.
Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. An easy question is for the good tall senator from Natrona County that, yes, exactly, that won't change one bit if we can implement it in a timely manner. If we're all jammed up on under 50 years old on October or November 30th of 2014, yes, then they'll be having to issue licenses to all these people on that day with a four-year expiration. If you go in just as your license expires, and I'm sure you're pushing the 50-year-old part, you'll have to be done by 2014, but you'll get it issued in 2010. Was that when you said it expired? 2009, yours expires in 2013 when you go back again on your birthday. They'll give you the new Real ID compliant. It'll be the same expiration 4 years later. You're good to go. So none of that will change unless we all wait to that last day, and then it'll be from that day 4 years later. What I was saying about address change, right now you can go in and get an address change. The expiration date doesn't change. So if you did it 6 months before that expiration date, you'd still have to come in 6 months later and do the license over to get a four-year license. But if you did an address change 6 months earlier, the new four-year expiration date starts from that date 4 years out. So it changes only if you do. If you don't do it, it doesn't change. The good senator from the mother county, some days I wonder if you know who you are anyway, so I guess I can't answer that question. But what was your question, Kat? Remember your question? There is the fraudulent document training. This was how we're going to keep this secure. As part of on page 4, subsection C, the department shall require fraudulent document recognition training for all employees handling those documents listed or engaged in the issuance of driver's license, and that'll be one of their part of their training will be document handling. And I know there's another part in this bill which I hope to find for you that says there's going to be more stringent regulations in place.
Further discussion. Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me ask a little more fundamental question now. And back on the first, back on the issuance thing, the description I had does concern me because right now, we've got a system that very nicely spaces it out. If you've got a situation where you go in a little early, get your license renewed, your expiration date changes, that's degrading the uniform system we have now, and I think we ought to change that. And so what if it means it runs 4.5 years? Let's get that little piece fixed. On a more comprehensive note, you know, this is something that the federal government did. And really, it's a case of Enzi's Law. And you all know what that is. Anything worth reacting to is worth overreacting to. And many of the security measures they have put in since then, frankly, I think have been in that category. A lot of hassle, no gain for it. And this is going to be a significant hassle for our constituents. If we're going to do it, this bill is probably the way to do it. Because it allows us to phase in over time. It'll avoid backlogs and a crisis. I can see that argument. So we need to make a decision at this point. Are we going to comply or are we not going to comply? And Mr. Chairman, it makes sense to me if there is some good evidence that these new driver's licenses are really going to make us significantly more secure, then it's probably worth... The money's not what's important here. It's the degree of hassle to the people we represent. If there's some evidence that that's worth doing and important, then we ought to do it, and this bill's the way to do it. If that evidence is lacking, and it really appears that the federal government has just laid a bunch of new hassles on us because they thought they had to do something and didn't think out what the something was, then we ought to say, no, turn this bill down, suspend the rules, introduce a bill informing them we do not intend to comply in no uncertain terms. Tell the Highway Department not to take any steps to implement. We ought to make a decision one way or the other. So I would like, to help me make up my mind, I would like some discussion as to what the real benefits are to putting in this ID, and are they something that we can go home in good conscience and tell the people we represent, yeah, it's a sensible thing. It's going to be a hassle to you, but it's going to be worth it. Or should we go home and tell them, the feds laid a ridiculous one on us. We ain't going to do it. Write your congressman. Deal with your congressman. Otherwise, you'll be hassled by the feds so many years. And I think that's a decision we may need to make at this point. And I would want to hear, before I join the distinguished senator from Carbon County and just saying no, I would like to hear more discussion of what good is this really going to do.
Senator Esquivel.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of some of the difficulties that I foresee with this situation, I'll give you a good example. I have an uncle whose name, legal name, is Domingo Garcia. When he went in the service, World War II, the individuals that were there, first sergeant, whatever, couldn't pronounce Domingo that easily. So they asked him, well, what does that mean? What does it mean in English? Well, in English, Domingo, as I'm sure many of you, probably all of you know, means Sunday. Now, Sunday is not a very common name for a male in English, but Domingo is a very common name in Spanish. And they both mean the same thing. And I've tossed it around in my mind as to if he goes in and says, my name is Sunday, even though his birth certificate says Domingo, they both mean the same thing. Is that his legal name? The spelling is different, but he's gone by with the name Sunday for the last 60 years. I'm not sure what kind of hassle he's going to have. Another example, several years ago, first time I'd ever been out of the United States or planning on going out of the United States, I applied for a passport. My birth certificate says New Mexico. My passport came back showing that I was born in Mexico. You know, there are some people that apparently don't know that New Mexico is a state. And, because you still have that human error. And that's one of the concerns I have. Now, I don't know what kind of hassle I'm going to have in terms of trying to correct that document, but I guess I'm going to be finding out shortly. But those are just some of the practical difficulties that I foresee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the concerns of the good senator from Laramie County, and I also appreciated some of the things stated by my fellow senator from Natrona County. And I shared some of those same concerns during the interim as we dealt with this issue. And really, ladies and gentlemen, what it boils down to is that our Department of Transportation is in a kind of a tough spot. You know, they're being told that it's time to comply with this federal legislation, and they're coming to us to tell us how we can do that, and how we can do that without putting our constituents back home, Senator, you know, in a pretty tough spot. We can put it off if we want to, and maybe it'll go away. Kind of like many of you dealt with that issue of 55 miles an hour years ago, hoping that that would go away. And then pretty soon they said, well, you can keep doing what you're doing if you want to, but we're not going to build any more highways for you. Now, is that what's coming down the pike here? Because that's what I asked in committee the other day. You know, what are we looking at if we don't do this? Well, we're not real sure, and neither is the Department of Transportation. But as the good senator from Gillette said, you know, we face a 2014 date. If we begin the process now, that's the least inflicted pain that we could vote for on our constituents back home. Now, I have some of the same sentiments that the senator from our mother county expressed. I'm not crazy about this whole notion of real ID, but it is what we have, and it is what the Department of Transportation needs some guidance on, and that's what we're paid to do. Thanks.
Further discussion, Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if some of you recall or not, but I recall probably a year or so ago seeing a report that said that two of the terrorists that flew the airplanes into the World Trade Center had Wyoming licenses that they had received. And they had used those licenses apparently for identification on several occasions. And because of that, you know, kind of that put Wyoming right out there, like right in the bullseye, in the target, for being able to just easily get a driver's license anyway without any kind of checking or anything. And so we need to think about this. I don't know whether this is either here or there in this discussion, but the fact of the matter is that did happen, and that's a reality. So we need to think about that.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That kind of follow on what my colleague from Natrona County has put forth. If you've ever worked out of the country, and I'll go back to when I was working in Russia, we all had to have passports to get in and out and had to have visas to get in and out, but so did the people. And all the Russians had a little red book that they carried, and it was the internal passport is how it translated. China, same way. When I worked in Vietnam, same way. So when an expat would go into a hotel or do any kind of business, the first thing they did was try to take your passport. Well, if you've traveled over there a lot, what you learn to do is you had a stack of copies of your first page, and you just handed them that, and that's really all they needed. But once they took that, you know, somebody gave them their passport, they had complete control over you. You couldn't leave until they gave you your passport back. Now, all we're doing here with all this real ID stuff, and it's like the good senator said, the train's on the tracks, but we're all headed towards the same thing, that where we will have some kind of, it won't be a driver's license in the future if you don't drive. But somebody, everybody will have some kind of ID that they'll be required to carry at all times, and that's how some of these other governments around the world are already doing it. They know where everybody is, and that's the way they control where everybody is.
Senator Von Flattern. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I hope we can. There's a lot of philosophical issues involved with this and whether the federal government has a hammer over us or what that might be. Yes, the train is on the track. I'm starting to sense a train wreck, but I will tell you that there's a minimal amount of hassle to our citizens. Yes, you'll have to show up with another actual one of this list of documents. That's true, to get your license.
Can you imagine the hassle, though, for us that do use airlines to go through that extra scrutiny and security? And should they make it even more rigid where they say, you just won't get on? I'm sorry, they do have that power, and I don't know how to defend against it. And whether Uncle Domingo, whether he has still issues, he would have issues today getting on an airline. And so he should legally, if he hasn't already taken care of that and changed it. Human error is everywhere. There's nothing we can do to take care of that. But I can tell you the train is definitely on the tracks. I've been to enough of these meetings at the national level to know that everybody was in revolt. I know they gave us the big poison pill to start with, so when they eased the restrictions, we were, you know, getting ready to thank them. And that's stupid. But the reality is it truly started out at $11 to $18 million, 18 to 25 employees. I mean, that was the state of Wyoming. And so now we're looking at $500,000 yearly, $1 million grant for them to take care of startup, $500,000 out of the road money. Hate to see that, but that's reality. But you know what? It will be a lot less hassle for our citizens when they go to an airport, when they have to do anything else with the federal government, including the armed services or any other place where you have to show an ID to get a document out of them. So I ask you to vote for this bill. Let's move it on. We need to make a slight amendment to fix the 4.5 years because we need that other. By the way, it allows you to renew the same way we do now. You can get a 4-year extension in an 8-year period with just an eye test. That's still there. So it's not that big of an additional hassle. And I ask for your support on this bill.
Senator Geis.
Go ahead with us or not. If we buy this license plate, we'll have a lot better ID. Nobody will be able to duplicate it on it like you can the one we have today. And so I'd ask you to vote aye on the bill.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if the committee, I'm sure you did, heard discussions from the Department of Transportation on the likelihood that those deadlines will be enforced. I know it started out, we had deadlines we were going to have to meet, and then they said, well, we're not sorry, but you don't have to do that anymore. Now you can just say your quote, I think the word was making progress toward that. Are we going to see the same thing? Have you any idea, or does the department have an idea? Is that deadline for the convenience? We understand the deadlines out there, but are we starting this early, in essence 5 years, in order to lessen the inconvenience on our citizens because of the 4-year driver's license period, or is there at least maybe some chance that all we have to do for a year or two still is to certify that we're making progress? Did you have that discussion with the Department of Transportation? What was the result?
Further discussion? Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Up once again. Before March 11th of 08, we had to apply, must request an extension by that deadline in May of extension of May 2008 deadline within 60 days after publication of rules. So in May of 2008, we actually had to be in compliance, and we applied prior to that, March 11th of 2008, and got the extension that we're living on now. So that was the last extension granted anybody. So I can't say that, once again, enough states do something and the government says California can't get in line quick enough, so we're going to do this. These are set in slowly drying concrete. That's about as best as well as I can say that. I can tell you that I just did receive verification that the license will be rounded up to your birthday. So you can actually get a 4-year, 11-month and something license. So that still will end your license on your birthday, even if it has to be rounded up. The wonders of modern technology, and I'm sure he was texting while he was driving. But that's the best I can answer that as far as extensions.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flattern's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report
that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 38. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 38 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 88. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File Number 88, sponsored by Senator Perkins, required use of ignition interlock devices, and act relating to restricted driver's licenses. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Amended. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with the favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Meyer, Peterson, and Townsend. No, Senators Massey and Nicholas. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, they do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 88. And, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 be read in.
Senate File Number 88, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 197.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that amendment. I'm going to attempt to explain a little bit about what we did with the amendment so that you'll know, and then we can vote on that. It went on to having an amendment from Committee Number 2, and then I'll turn it over to Senator Perkins to explain the bill. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 2, we liked the program. We thought the program was great, but there were members of our committee who believe that within the Department of Transportation there were funds that had to be used and could be used specifically for the prevention of drunken driving. And so all Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 did was say that the program is right, but use Department of Transportation funds which are allocated for that particular purpose. That may not be correct, but we sure knew we would get an answer if there was. So with that, that's what the amendment does. I don't want you to vote on that at this time, but at this time I'd like to turn it over to the good Senator Perkins to explain his bill.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what you have before you is with Senate File 88 is a program to make the use of ignition interlocks in the event under certain circumstances of convictions for driving under the influence. After last session, as you may remember, we killed a bill that would have enhanced some of the driving penalties for DUI. And many of us left here with a bad taste in our mouth, went back and started to research this issue about how could we reduce the number of DUIs without necessarily putting people in jail for a longer period of time. Worked on this with also the good representative from Washakie County, who's also a co-sponsor, worked very hard on this. Mr. Chairman, this is a situation of where the world is a small place. One of my law partners was on a cruise, and on a cruise he ran into a legislator from New Mexico who he mentioned that law partners was a legislator, gave him my card. When he came back, and as I researched this, I found out New Mexico had recently done this and had some success in this. So I got the card and I called the senator, who then put me in touch with the senators who carried and promoted the bills in New Mexico to do this very thing. And from that, we found out something that's very important. If you look, you've got a handout that I gave to you today. It's a color handout. It consists of three pages. The first page is a graph, a bar graph that's got some bars on it. And this is by our Dr. Richard, you see his name there at the top. And he's someone who did a lot of work and research with respect to and did a lot of testimony as they went through and did this process in New Mexico and instituted these laws in that sister state. And when you look at this bar, this will just give you an example of some of the things that they found. If you look at the blue bar on there, you see the years across the bottom of 2000 through 2 through 2006. Note that they passed the ignition interlock in this particular state on that became effective on January the 1st of 2003. What you see in the blue line there is you see the recidivism rate of a DUI arrest, and what that stands for is if you had a DUI, if you were convicted of a DUI, if you're arrested for a DUI, and then within the next year you're arrested again for a DUI, that shows you, the blue bar represents the percentages of DUI arrests that then were subsequently arrested again within a year for DUI. The red bar shows a recidivism of a DUI conviction. Same thing, only now we're talking about convictions instead of arrests, that they're someone who gets their DUI arrest, how frequently and what the percentage is that they were rearrested within the next year. The green bar represents the fraction of convicted offenders who were rearrested within 1 year after they had ignition interlock in their car, installed in their vehicle, pursuant to the New Mexico statute, which this statute is modeled after. What the long and short of it is this, Mr. Chairman, is that there was ultimately a 64% reduction in recidivism with DUI drivers after they've been for rearrest after a conviction of DUI. They were 64% reduction in those who were arrested in the following year for a second offense and the subsequent conviction. The other thing that became aware is, as you looked at the statistics, overall the DUIs in this particular state reduced by about roughly 30% in DUIs overall. That certainly seemed to be significant results in a time when we're seeing increasing numbers of DUIs in our state for various reasons. One other thing that I would just mention before I launch off into explanation of the bill is, after we went home last year, I got a letter from a constituent in Casper, and he writes this: Mr. Perkins, I would certainly hope that if you're elected again, I wasn't running for election, but I appreciated his sentiment, that you would vote to keep this sort of thing from happening. And he sent me a news clip from another part of the state where a Wamsutter man pleaded guilty to charges stemming from a crash that killed a woman near near Gillette. This particular man pleaded not guilty to charges of aggravated vehicular homicide and two felony counts of driving under the influence where serious bodily injury occurred. This particular fellow, the victim died in a head-on collision with the accused's vehicle south of Gillette. And when the long and short of it is, it came to this, that ultimately this person was sitting on a bar stool in a bar, which is in violation of a probation for a conviction while in California. This also would result in, he also had three prior drunk driving arrests. And so, this long and short of it is this, Mr. Chairman, I'm just not convinced that people make good decisions sitting on a bar stool. This man was looking at, even not barring the fact if he'd gone out and driven and not hurt anybody, not killed anybody, he would have been looking, because of the number of convictions, he would have been looking at 2 years in prison, because that would have been his fourth DUI convicted, plus whatever the probation revocation would have been for whatever charge he had, because I'm sure the drunk driving was a condition of his probation that he was on. So you have somebody who's staring down the barrel of probably somewhere between at least potentially 2 years, maybe longer, depending on what the other offense was, and he still made the decision to drink and drive. And so ultimately it comes down to this. We physically have to find a way to prevent this type of thing from happening. And if I can take you to the bill now, I think it'll help show you what this will do. These devices also, as before we launch in, I've got a picture here. If you want to swing by my desk and look at it, ignition interlock devices, they look a lot like the old mobile phones that were in your car that you used to pick up and talk. You know, before we got worried about cell phones, used to have those and you pick them up in the cord. And they look a lot like that, only this one, instead of put to your ear, you put to your mouth and you blow in it. And ultimately, it's tied into your ignition. And if you blow a .02 or higher, it's not going to start. Not only that, it will log in the system the date and the circumstance under which you failed to start the vehicle. And that's logged in there and for future reference. And the vehicle will not start with that. The other thing it does is, when you're driving, it will at various intervals
ask, it'll have you, it'll give a warning, you have to do it again. So that, it, if you were back in the days when you used to measure distances in Wyoming by the number of beers you might drink, you could start your car and start out and enjoy yourself on the way. Well, this anticipates that, and sooner or later you're going to have to blow into this thing to have your car continue to go. While it doesn't shut off the ignition after you've gotten it started and you're driving and you do a random check, it doesn't shut it off, but it will ignite your panic button system. So now your light will be demonstrating through flashing and honking that something is awry in the cockpit of your vehicle. So anyway, we'll take you through the bill very quickly. On page 2, in this first section here, you might be scratching your head over what that's about. This actually is intended to close a little bit of a loophole. If you're convicted for homicide by vehicle under that provision, you don't get your license back. And so what this is just making it clear that in this, because the purpose of this is that you can get your license back, you can drive your vehicle if you've got an ignition interlock. If you lose it for because you've killed someone while driving, you've been convicted of that particular crime, you're not going to get it back because you put an ignition interlock in your car. So that might, you might, if you were scratching your head about that, that's what that's about. The next several pages, the idea is, the first one is the 31.5.223, which is our DUI statute. You've got a conviction under there. For a first conviction, if your blood alcohol was 0.15 or greater, then you would be required to, after conviction on that, to have a ignition interlock installed in any car that you would drive for a period of 1 year. On a second offense, it would require ignition interlock to be installed in that vehicle for 2 years. Third offense, 3 years. Fourth offense, for life. We're just not going to mess with you, although there is an opportunity after 5 years of good behavior that you can apply to a judge, and if you can demonstrate that you could have it off now, that you've turned your habits around, that you could have it removed later on. If you go to page 4, you've got the same function again. You'll see it basically restated, but that's for minors, offending minors who are convicted of driving under the influence under the same circumstances, and with the same penalties attached. If you go to the next page, you get the next place, the section you're dealing with is on page 6, 31.6.102. This is ultimately has to do with an advisement with respect to implied consent. If you're pulled over, they want you to take the breathalyzer test or your test. They have to give you certain advisements. This one includes in the advisement that whether if you do take the test and you're convicted, that you'll be subject to an ignition interlock. If you refuse to take the test, it also advises you would be subject to having to drive vehicles only equipped with an ignition interlock. Beginning at the bottom of page 7 and continuing on over pages 8 and 9 is a section. These are basically conforming language for that advisement that we just talked about. Going to the top of page 9, now we're talking about implied consent. We have on page 9 implied consent for adults, and we have implied consent for youthful drivers. What would happen is basically an implied consent would be a conviction that would require ignition interlock if you were to refuse implied consent. Continuing on to page 10, pages 10, 11, and 12 are the various, and over to 13 are various pages regarding the administration and enforcement of the ignition interlock. Basically what happens is the ignition interlock has to have the data logger, which records every instance in which the device prevented the engine from starting during the period between recalibrations. The ignition interlock has to be installed by a ignition interlock service provider, which is certified by the Department of Transportation. We do have experience with ignition interlocks in the state of Wyoming. They are in use by voluntary use now. The Department of Transportation has experience both administering those and getting the reports and doing things. So they do have some experience with this. On page 13, top of page 13, would establish an indigent program for those who are unable to pay for an ignition interlock. If your finances, your financial condition is such that you could not pay for this by yourself, which everyone else who can would be required to pay for it yourself, and this is what the appropriation has to go to, is the amount that would pay for this. And there's nothing particularly sacred about this. We just picked a simple device, which basically, if you could qualify for federal food stamps, you qualify for the financial assistance, in having this fund pay for your ignition interlock. The ignition lock has to be the service provider has to provide monthly reports on each ignition interlock device, and also they have to recalibrate and service the ignition every 60 days to make sure it's not tampered with. Ultimately, what happens? You get the ignition interlock. Your license is reissued. There'll be a stamp on your license that says that you've got an ignition interlock requirement. So it would appear on your driver's license. So if you're pulled over, the police officer would know that that indeed you're required to have this on any vehicle that you drive. We do have on page 15. In the middle of the page there, lines 4 through 13, we do have an employer exception, and we'll get to an amendment that talks about this here in a minute. But ultimately, the ignition interlock provides for an employer exception. If you drive a car for your employer, you wouldn't have to have one in that car, provided that it's only used for business purposes and it's not available to use for non-business purposes. So any specialty vehicles, or if you drive it, you go to the yard, pick up a vehicle and drive it, you're not going to have an ignition lock on that car. But if that car is available to you to drive and use as though your own, you would be required to have an ignition lock on that vehicle. You get back in the rest of the bill, or continuing on with the bill. If you drive without a ignition interlock, then that, and you're caught, that ignition, that would then count as though another conviction. It's basically going to add a year onto your ignition interlock time if you're caught driving a vehicle without an ignition interlock. There's also some misdemeanor penalties for driving without an ignition interlock. Up to 30 days in jail for a second offense. At least 30 days and not more than 6 months for a second offense. For a first offense, 7 days, at least 7 days and not more than six months for the first offense. Also, the same offense for those who aid and abet someone in avoiding an ignition interlock. So if you blow into your buddy's ignition interlock for you, you have the potential to end up with an ignition lock on your own car plus some jail time. Going through that, I think that's pretty much the biggest part of the bill. I do have some amendments that we can talk about in a minute. But ultimately, at this time, Mr. Chairman, we'll go back to the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, which deals with the change from appropriation to just requiring the funds to be expended out of that. I would also note that the fiscal note indicates that there would be $60,000 a year we raised from, there's a $15 fee associated with obtaining these types of licenses, and that there would be some offset there. That money would go into the highway fund, and the money with the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 that was talked about changes that. Also, we'll talk about the other amendment in a minute, but the amount turns out to be less with the appropriations amendment, which should be no surprise to anyone who's been to appropriations this or other years. So at this time, we'll stand for questions on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
We're on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Question being called for on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 88. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, I made the motion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Not to Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Larson. It's Senator Larson's motion. Stand for the correct correction on that. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed the Senate to Senate File 88. Senator Nicholas. Senator Burns.
Amendment Number 1 is passed Committee of the Whole, not the Senate.
Thank you.
Apparently Democrat land.
Senator Nicholas.
I'm just getting ready for Number 2.
We have Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 88. Please be read in.
Senate file number 88, standing committee amendment number 2, page 19, line 5.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I move standing committee amendment number 2 to Senate file 88. And while we hate to dump on people's amendments, we do think it is appropriate to only spend what you have to. They had $60,000 worth of revenue. An extra $25,000 was all that was needed. We urge your support of the amendment. A few dollars here, a few dollars there. Pretty soon it adds up.
Further discussion on standing committee amendment number 2. Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt standing committee amendment number 2 to Senate file 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number 2 has passed the committee of the whole. We're back on the bill. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this time, I'd ask that we read in committee of the whole amendment number 1.
The reading clerk, please read in standing committee of the whole amendment number 1.
Senate file 88, committee of the whole amendment number 1, page 2, lines 19 through 23.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this time, I'd move standing committee amendment, committee of the whole amendment number 1, and ask we dispense with further reading of it. What standing committee amendment number 1 does, we had some testimony from some interested parties in the during the committee. While the committee didn't take up those, I spent some time with those individuals after the committee amendment, and this represents the suggestions that they had that I thought made the bill better. And so I present those at this time and go through them very quickly. What you find in the first several are very easy to understand once you understand what's going on. The first rule amendment is lines 3 through 7 on the amendment. And what we're doing there is going back and referring to language that is defined earlier in the statute. And so what we're doing here is just defining this language, and then we'll use it consistently throughout the bill. So what the first lines 3 through 7 do is set up that language, and then the next several amendments, the amendments on page 4, and the amendments all the way down through the amendment on page 6, which is lines 24 through 26, are all conforming amendments just to change that language and use consistent language throughout the bill. The amendment on page 15 has to do with the employee exemption on line 15. And what we're doing that, the exemption would now read, essentially, if you go to page 15 and line 11, if you look there after the word of normal business activities, it would strike the remainder of that paragraph, but add after activities the language that you see there on lines 29 through line 31 of the amendment, that essentially would read that the employer's vehicle without an ignition interlock device. Well, I'll go back and read the whole sentence. Basically, what we've got, if you go to line 9, except that a licensee may operate an employer's vehicle without an ignition interlock device installed during normal business activities, and not used by the licensee for non-business purposes, and that's talking about the employer's vehicle. And so it's kind of broad language, but that's what it's intended to get at, is ultimately that as long as you don't use the employer's car as your own, that you don't have to have an ignition interlock on your employer's vehicle. Have had some discussion with industry and others, and hopefully that's going to be an acceptable. It's a little bit broad, but hopefully that will allow individuals to continue to work and not burden employers with having ignition interlocks and not potentially cost people their jobs because there has to be ignition interlocks on the vehicles that they drive. Amendments on page 16 just changes that shall to may. If you look at on that particular page that was talking about if there was someone violated or was convicted of driving without ignition or lock, it required the department to revoke the license. We changed that from mandatory to discretionary. Ultimately, the purpose of these things is to keep you from driving your vehicle without license. It's been determined that not only does it do that, but it also helps change behavior and help people understand when they've had too much to drink and that shouldn't be driving. So we want to limit that and leave some discretion with the administrative process to figure out when enough is enough. For the ones on line 17, what you were having there on the pages 17, those amendments, if you go through the old language, ultimately what's going to happen if you violate it or you screwed up and blew your chance with your ignition interlock and you end up driving a car without an ignition interlock, you're going to be banned from driving with an ignition interlock. This amendment changes it and loops it back in so that if you're caught without driving your ignition interlock, you're just basically going to add, it's going to count as a conviction. So you end up basically adding another year to the time the ignition interlock is going to be on your vehicle instead of requiring that you now have forfeited your right to use the ignition interlock. The idea behind that is simply that people are going to drive anyway, and if we're going to have them on the road, we'd rather have them in cars with their ignition interlocks in them. And so that's basically what those amendments do. I think that completes my explanation of the bill, and I stand for questions at this time.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Senator Hines, Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, a question on the amendment in the section on page 1, line 29 through 34. Am I interpreting that if a person that have a work vehicle, then he cannot use it for non-business either, the licensee? Or am I misinterpreting that in that section?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what we're trying to do there is ultimately that you're prohibited from driving any vehicle that doesn't have an ignition interlock once you've had the conviction that would require you to have an ignition interlock. What we're trying to do on page 11 in subsection B is, excuse me, that's not right, paragraph 2 on page 15 is create an exception to that general rule. The exception would be that you can operate your employer's vehicle without an ignition interlock. However, the exception to the exception, and only lawyers would create exceptions to exceptions, but ultimately the exception to that exception is if that vehicle is available for use by the employee for non-business purposes. If that's the case, in other words, and the idea is there is if you have an employer's vehicle that is yours 24/7 and you can drive it for work and not for work, you're going to have an ignition interlock in that vehicle. But if you only use it for business purposes, then you don't have to. And so that's the idea of that exception, is to try and create not a full exception just because it's an employer's vehicle. There's just too many people and too many self-employeds that, you know, you could get around that simply by saying, hey, man, it's employer's car. I mean, if you had that, why not just go incorporate, work for yourself, and then have a company-owned vehicle, and you could avoid that. So what we're trying to do is make that a little bit tighter to where one that's truly used for business purposes is exempt, one that's used for business and personal use would not be exempt.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? Question being called on Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 88. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill? You ready for the question? All those in favor, Senator Ross.
I will be brief, Mr. Chairman, but I think it's important that I bring some perspective to this. As you can tell, I'm a co-sponsor on this. But during the interim, our Judiciary Committee was tasked by Management Council to look at sentencing on DUIs. And as you know, I mean, there's bills all over the place about enhancing penalties. And it became clearly evident to us as we tried to gather information that it was unintelligible. We just certainly just could not correlate how sentences were being administered throughout the state very well. In fact, municipal court documents don't really even exist except on microfiche, and they're almost unintelligible when you look at them. The reason I'm on this bill, though, is because this appears to me to be the one bill that gets at the heart of drinking and driving and provides a methodology for keeping people from drinking and driving. We can have sentences all over the world of up to 50 or mandatory minimums and all of that good stuff. But as you've seen and heard in testimony over the years and even today, with the example from the good senator from Natrona County, that just doesn't seem to work. But this has been proven to work, and I'd urge your favorable consideration of this. The alternative is simply to just fill up our prisons.
Senator Coe.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, just a question, and I'm a supporter of the bill also, but on page 15, paragraph D, it talks about no restricted license may be issued under this article until the department has received a certificate of installation from a certified ignition interlock service provider for every vehicle. I read in the handout that those devices cost between $70 and $150 in New Mexico. My question has to do with, are these going to be readily available for the licensee to purchase, and are there places in Wyoming where these can be acquired?
Senator Perkins. Thank you. My good friend from Park County, that's one of the beauties about this is that we have several hundred ignition interlocks already in use in the state of Wyoming. And there are basically 10 companies out there that provide ignition interlocks that are available. The experience in the state of Wyoming right now with the voluntary program that's there is that there's about $110 or so, $100 to $110 to have it installed, and then the cost is $60 to $70 a month to maintain that over the period of time. They're as near as I know, they're readily available throughout the state. I also believe that once they become mandatory, that there's opportunities for individuals to, I think that there will be an expansion of entrepreneurship to fill this void. In doing that, I can tell you also that the Department of Transportation already looks and has a number of vendors, and they certify those vendors as being able to participate and be able to carry out the program. So that framework for certification and reporting throughout the state already exists. Further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that we do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 88 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Will the reading clerk read the committee the whole report?
Mr. President, the Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 103, do pass. Senate File 21, do pass, amended. Senate File 34, do pass. Senate File 38, do pass, amended. Senate File 88, do pass, amended. Senator Hastert, Chairman.
Senator Hastert.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Report's adopted. Reports from standing committees.
January the 29th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 100, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Meyer. Sorry, it says do not pass. Reports back with a recommendation that it do not pass. Aye, Senators Myers, Nicholas, Peterson, Townsend. No, Senator Massey, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. January the 29th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 102, engrossed, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Larson, Martin, Perkins, Schiffer. No, Senator Case. Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 29th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 67, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Larson, and Perkins. No, Senators Martin and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 29th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 11, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Cole, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resource, will meet in about 10 minutes in S-15, and we're going to take up Senate File 133, Pet Animal Care and Facility Act, SJ-4, Blacktail Prairie Dogs.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. In the committee room, Senate File 132, Board of Bombing Membership, Senate File 137, Healthcare Rehab Facility, Senate File 18, Mental Injury Workers' Compensation, Senate File 141, Midwives Licensure, Senate File 66, Medicaid Foot Care. We may have to shuffle the order of that, both because of commitments that members have with other bills and because we suddenly lost a half hour off our meeting time. So be warned.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, the Senate Appropriations Committee will meet in S-13. Upon adjournment, we'll take up Senate File 67, Water Development Funding, from this afternoon, which we didn't complete. After that, we'll go on to the other scheduled items, Senate File 10, Brucellosis Management Program, Senate File 87, Wolf Brucellosis Testing, and Senate File 73, Gillette-Madison Pipeline Project. The Appropriations Committee meets again tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to consider Senate File 24, Healthcare Reform Demonstration Project, Senate File 106, Medication Disposal Program, and Senate File 99, Career and Technical Training Grants. Mr. President, we're also going to be meeting on Monday at 1 p.m. to consider Senate File 39, Child Health Insurance Program, Senate File 108, Long-Term Care Facilities. And on adjournment on Monday, we'll actually meet back in room 204, our regular room, to consider Senate File 138, Health Care Professionals Database, and Senate File 146, in-car supercomputer funding. Thank you.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Friday, 30 minutes after the noon recess in S-18, to take up Senate File 135. We'll continue that of risk management. Senate Joint Resolution 5, Hydraulic Fracturing, and House Bill number 34, Liquor Licenses Industry Representative.
Mr. Vice President, Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning, Friday, January 30th at 8 a.m. to consider the following bills: House Bill 19, Criminal Procedure, Mental Evaluations; House Bill 20, Criminal Procedure, Administration of Antipsychotic Drugs; and Senate File 136, Homicide Aggravating Circumstances.
You've heard the motion. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 9:30 a.m. Friday, January 30th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. The Senate is adjourned.